This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Hello, just before we start, a little note. We do use a couple of abbreviations in this podcast. The ECB, which is the European Central Bank, and the Fed, which is the Federal Reserve. Thanks very much. Enjoy the show.
Good day, everyone. I'm Ron Insana. Welcome to the U.S. Lens. I'm senior advisor to Schroders North America. And if you've been watching of late in the markets, the everything rally seems to be continuing unabated, with a wide variety of assets moving higher in price, particularly equities, both in the United States and abroad. The other thing that's moving higher lately as well are interest rates, both domestically and overseas. Now, the question is, at what point will we see interest rates impinge on the so-called everything rally that's taking place? And how will central bank policies around the world affect markets going forward? Joining me now to discuss all of that and more is Adam Farstrup. He is head of multi-assets in the Americas for Schroders. Adam, good to have you. Thanks for being with us today.
Good morning, Ron. It's good to be with you, too, with nothing to talk about clearly in the markets today.
Let me just start with where we are in the cycle, both domestically and globally. We seem to have missed the opportunity for a synchronized global economic recovery, although there is a recovery ongoing. And as stated earlier, that has benefited several different asset classes. Where would you place us right now in terms of the recovery cycle?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question to think about where we are in the cycle. And I think compared to where we were in the spring, when we were talking about that prospect of a synchronized recovery, although I should probably say most people weren't expecting as strong an emerging markets recovery due to the lag in vaccinations there. But, you know, when we think about sort of the cycle, we've had a very strong cycle in terms of that recovery, but it hasn't extended quite as far as I think most of us hoped for at the beginning of what they were going to call the hot vaxxed summer, right? Yeah. So what we've seen is we're still in the recovery phase of the cycle. The question is it a really fast cycle or is it more of a normal speed cycle? Our models seem to indicate that we're still in recovery, have not actually moved into expansion yet. If you look at some of the more diffusion-based indexes, right, these are ones that tend to be sort of quicker to respond because of some of the employment figures that we're seeing, where you've seen a slowdown in that employment progress. You know, those are suggesting maybe a faster move through the cycle. But what's not clear yet is whether that's just noise in the models. And so our views are that we're still moving into that expansion phase over the next several months.
But let me ask you about that, because it seems that, and this is my own generalization, but it seems that everything that we're talking about right now, whether it's growth, whether it's inflation, whether it's global growth, is still linked to the pandemic, the pandemic of the unvaccinated in the United States and in some markets overseas. Is that still the single biggest variable that is keeping us from going from recovery to expansion?
I think so. I think it's certainly causing some of the noise that we're seeing in the numbers. And you mentioned inflation. One of the things I think that's notable is that compared to even just 3 months ago, our views about inflation are much more moderated, in that we think the markets have largely priced in the inflation risk that we're seeing in the West right now. I think that story could be with us in terms of the supply side disruptions and the risks that that presents. I think that could be with us maybe longer than we expected, but it doesn't seem like it's at the same time persistent inflation. So that's priced into the markets. What doesn't seem to be priced into the markets is the normalization in interest rates. And that, again, I think is linked to the pandemic, right? Because the employment report we just had seemed to be two things going on there. If you look within hospitality and leisure, you're definitely seeing a slowdown in activity because of fears over the Delta variant. You're seeing that has slowed some of the employment there. But on the other side of it, There's some indications that the disappointing employment report we got last week reflects the fact that actually there's a shortage of workers, right? So we got an update on the job openings from the Fed on Wednesday that showed actually a record number of job openings in July. So that's a little bit more lagged than the employment report. But it does seem like the disruptions in childcare, the changes in views from workers in terms of what kinds of jobs they want and how they're going to, you know, frankly, engage with those jobs also seems to be having an impact on employment and therefore the speed of recovery.
Yeah, I mean, we could spend hours on the employment situation, given that there are, you know, 2 million more jobs open than there are available workers. We had 3 million people retire early. We have 1.8 million women who left the workforce to oversee hybrid education for their kids during the depths of the pandemic. Unless this situation rights itself, is there any way to square the circle really in the employment world where people's views literally have changed based on the pandemic about what they want to do and how much they want to get paid and where they want to do it from?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have those answers. I don't think anybody does. I think what I would say from a market standpoint, how does this impact us as investors? What we're watching over the next couple months is, do we start to see the participation rate start moving up again? Yeah. Right. That will tell a very large part of the story in terms of how this will influence the growth story.
So with respect to that, I mean, as or if we move from recovery to expansion, then there's the questions about central bank policy. We've seen the European Central Bank indicate that it may start tapering before the Fed. The Fed, even Jay Powell, has admitted that the Fed may start tapering this year. He didn't say when, even though a lot of members are saying, look, September. Given the data that we've seen, can anyone comfortably say that the Fed's going to go first or someone else may do it before they do?
Yeah, it's maybe a story of what does first actually mean, because, you know, I think our views are that the Fed is likely to start tapering this year. Now, whether this year means the, you know, second half of December or whether it means, you know, end of November, it is a different question. But we do think that it's likely it without any further growth disruptions or surprises on the employment side that they begin the process of tapering this year. What we've seen from the ECB, and I only had a few minutes to look at the statement before we started recording this, is, you know, my understanding of what the ECB announced today is that it's beginning to slow the pace of purchases. So it's a little bit different than the taper that the Fed's talking about, which is actually beginning to end the program of asset purchases. Whereas for the ECB, it's really about slowing the pace of those purchases. So I think that difference may be significant when you think about who goes first.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
All right, so let me ask about that. So let's assume for the moment then that the Fed, with respect to tapering, goes first. We've been living in a zero interest rate environment. We've been living in an environment where the Fed is purchasing $120 billion of Treasury and mortgage-backed securities every single month. Does it matter to the markets, going back to 2013 when there was a taper tantrum the last time that we went through this process? And is there an important distinction, something Jay Powell has suggested, between tapering and tightening when it comes to the behavior of financial markets?
I think there is, and I do think that the Fed is walking the proverbial tightrope over the pit of lava. So, you know, slipping either way is not likely to be a good outcome. I think they've done a good job so far. And back in 2013, there was, I think, an expectation of much quicker cycle of rate rises following the taper, at least in the initial reaction we saw in the markets. I think that the Fed has done a good job of preparing the markets for the taper. I think there's a lot of discussion about the need to taper those purchases. I mean, if we think again back 3 months ago when the market was much more concerned about inflation, that was really related to excess liquidity in the market with the combined fiscal and monetary programs we were seeing. So, you know, pulling back some of that monetary liquidity at a time when growth seems robust, I think the market can digest it, but that requires the Fed not to slip off the tightrope.
Yeah. And that also, again, forces them to put maybe a more concrete timeline on when tightening begins. It seems that there's some slippage, if you will, among the various participants on the Fed as to when that process should start. And that seems to be in many ways more of an open question for financial markets than when and how much the Fed starts to taper.
I think that's right. So our expectations right now are that we see, a rise in the front end of the curve as the tapering process begins, right? So the shorter duration bonds will start to see their interest rates rise modestly, but we're not looking at a steepening of the curve. So we don't see the long end of the curve moving out aggressively. And so that, when you sort of think about what that means from an investment standpoint, it means that you still have a pretty attractive interest rate environment for people who are issuing debt over longer maturities, because that end of the curve is not moving as much. So from a market standpoint, we think it's you need to be careful about how you think about bonds right now, because we are in a normalization cycle. That's the main point to take away from all of this discussion. Whether you look at the Fed, whether you look at the ECB, we are in a process of normalization of monetary policy. Whatever that normal level looks like from here, we're not sure, but there is some normalization which makes bonds, particularly government bonds, tricky right now. And on the growth side, while it's not we're not seeing the kind of amped up growth that we were perhaps expecting at the beginning of the summer, we are still seeing, what does it mean to be an expansion? It means that you will still see economic growth coming through. And so that brings us to the equity market, which you haven't asked me about yet. But I would say that while equities have only gotten more expensive over the summer, the good news is that the earnings continue to come through. And so when we think about what are the risks for the market, I think a bigger risk than interest rates is an earnings disappointment, right? If we get an earnings shock, an earnings slowdown reflecting some fundamental growth weakness in the economy, the markets are going to react very negatively to that.
And with that, we've seen Wall Street analysts raise their third quarter earnings estimates in particular, and even farther out than that. So now some argue that the market's priced for perfection. And as you indicate, if we get earnings misses in the third quarter, it could be problematic. What's the likelihood of that? I mean, the comps get tougher year over year as we move forward. And again, with this Delta variant, depending on where you are in the country, certain industries, leisure and travel, for instance, are still struggling. So how do you come to a conclusion about what's a fair valuation against earnings expectations today?
Yeah, I think for the way you look at it is we tend to think in sort of much more macro terms, right? Where our team is not as involved in picking individual securities. So we think about it in sort of broad terms. We think you could see some disappointment in earnings and leisure that the market could digest. We think that you will see some impacts on earnings from the supply chain disruptions that are out there. We have that as one of our risk scenarios that we're concerned about. But by and large, we still think at this point in the cycle, when you compare equities to the alternatives, which is credit and government bonds, equities still look relatively more attractive, even as the risks around equities rise, because of those valuations, because of being priced to perfection. So it's not a fear of missing out that causes you to sort of be attracted to equities right now. It is the power of that earnings. You need to monitor those earnings very carefully. I think companies will do a pretty good job guiding around those earnings as we head into this kind of trickier quarter for them, because they know that the comps are going to be difficult. The other thing that you do need to watch is the margins, right? So if, again, we tie this back to, the employment picture we were talking about, we are seeing that impacting the employment cost index. And so that is likely to squeeze margins combined with the supply chain pressures. How does that flow through earnings is a question that is quite open right now.
Before I get to commodities and private assets, let me just ask you one more question about equities, and that's domestic versus international. I was just reviewing the tables for all the markets around the world, and largely speaking, they've all done very well with a few notable exceptions. Some parts of the world are outperforming Northern Europe, Austria has done quite well. Asia is mixed. How do you approach the domestic versus international question when it comes to equity allocations?
Yeah, it's, you know, we've been very bullish on the US for a long time. And then, you know, starting last year, we started dabbling in Europe. And frankly, we were early in thinking about how the picture of growth in Europe was going to play out. We are seeing certainly economic growth in Europe looks very attractive. But when you look at the equity market, it's a more complicated picture because of the composition of the equity market. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really hard to just blindly buy European equity beta right now. You need to be very selective in how you access those assets. But Europe looks very attractive and the US continues to look attractive. I would say that their relative attractiveness is much more equal now than it has been in the past. Whereas, you know, 18 months ago, we would have said US is far more attractive than what we're seeing in Europe in particular. In Asia, it's more complicated because of the China story. Yeah. And what we're seeing in the China story right now is not only the regulatory uncertainty that's being faced, but you're seeing PMIs in China rolling over and people don't know, you know, we don't know whether that's a technical feature that's happening right now or it's really some more fundamental weakness coming out of maybe the Delta variant or not. So on emerging markets, the valuations have actually gotten better on emerging markets. We're tempted, but we don't think it's quite there yet. And so Europe and the US to us look most attractive right now.
Now, we talked earlier a little bit about inflation and you see it potentially moderating. And if I understand you correctly, you kind of share the view of the Fed that it is somewhat transitory and pandemic related. So do you go long commodities as an inflation hedge or do you kind of step back and see what happens before taking the plunge?
It's an attractive point in the cycle to be long commodities right now because you get two things. You do get some inflation protection. Now, it's important to note that within commodities, they don't protect you from all forms of inflation, right? But they certainly have that inflation sensitivity and particularly to some of the supply chain disruptions that we're seeing right now. So that's a benefit. But the other thing that commodities do for you right now is they give you a different way to access the growth cycle. So if we're correct in the view that sort of, well, the growth cycle is, you know, moving into expansion, that's still a good period of time typically to own commodities. And with the valuations on equities being as challenging as they are, being able to spread your bets into something like commodities right now makes a lot of sense to us.
You talked about spreading bets. Private assets in a low yield environment is something that, you know, people talk about. We've seen record M&A activity so far this year. How important is that as an allocation of one's portfolio?
Yeah, it's not an asset that's in the center of our universe as multi-asset investors. We tend to think about more liquid assets. It's very clear that the number of assets available in the private markets just continues to increase. And so I think for investors who can take the illiquidity risk, private assets remain a very important part of investment strategy. We're seeing increasing allocations to those private assets. I think the question for investors will be, how do you actually manage your transition into some of those private assets as you wait for capital calls? How do you think about your asset allocation as you wait for your private funds to call the capital over when the growth picture in the near term has some uncertainty to it, right? You know, because you can see, we've seen this before where you get a crisis in the public markets and it suddenly presents opportunities on the private asset side. And now you're getting capital calls and having to sell your public assets when they're potentially under stress. So I think that's something that we're thinking pretty hard about and investors will need to deal with in any allocation to private assets, but it's not going away. Private assets will not go away as an important tool in investors' toolkit.
All right. Adam, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us today. Adam Farstrup is head of multi-asset for Schroders Americas. I'm Ron Insana. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, check out our website, schroders.com/theinvestor download. You can also get in contact with us about anything in the show or ideas for future shows at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. Please remember to subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review. We're now doing one show a week, which will be available every Thursday from 5 p.m. UK time. Thanks very much for listening, but above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.